Okay, let's unpack this. Think about buying insurance for your home, that big step, or, you know, even just renewing your car policy.
Yeah.
You're putting a lot of trust in your agent to guide you well, to look out for you.
You really are. It's a relationship built on that.
But what if they're navigating a whole series of ethical tight spots that you never even see?
Mm.
Today on The Deep Dive, we're diving straight into the fascinating and sometimes unsettling world of insurance ethics.
Yeah, it's a deep topic.
We've got some real-world scenarios lined up that might just change how you think about your insurance coverage and maybe the person who helped you get it.
What's fascinating right off the bat is that insurance is fundamentally built on, well, a bedrock of trust.
Uh-huh.
Policyholders trust insurers to come through when things go wrong. And insurers rely on policyholders to be upfront and honest.
Right.
The agent sits right in the middle of this. So where do their ethical responsibilities lie? That's exactly what we're going to explore.
Exactly. This isn't about abstract theories today. We pulled together some really compelling stuff writings that delve into the real ethical dilemmas that insurance agents face day to day.
Yeah, the nitty gritty.
How the entire insurance landscape is adapting to some pretty significant global shifts, the ongoing debates about common insurance practices, and a look at the actual legal and professional standards that, well, anyone in the business of selling insurance is expected to meet.
If we zoom out and look at the bigger picture, you'll see that these aren't isolated incidents.
Right.
The ethical considerations within the insurance world touch on some really fundamental questions about responsibility, fairness, and how we, you know, as a society, manage the uncertainties of life.
So our mission today is to cut through the technical jargon, the fine print, and really get to the core ethical tensions at work in insurance.
Yeah, peel back the layers.
We want to give you a clear understanding of the significant responsibilities that insurance professionals carry and the often complex challenges they have to navigate. Our goal is to equip you with insights that go far beyond just understanding the limits of your policy.
This raises a key question right from the start.
Yeah.
Who is the primary focus for an insurance agent's ethical obligations?
Good question.
Is it their own financial well-being through commissions? Is it the insurance company they represent and, like, their profitability?
Like the policyholder.
Is it the individual buying the policy and their specific needs? Or do they have a broader responsibility to the community as a whole?
Yeah.
These questions really come into sharp focus when we consider our first scenario.
Right. Imagine this. Bruce is an agent working for Ajax Insurance. Now, Bruce's father works at the local bank. You know, small town, news travels fast.
Yeah.
And through that connection, Bruce has learned that a couple named Jim and Ruth Kelly have somehow managed to get a mortgage for a house on Chestnut Circle.
Okay.
The catch. Bruce has very good reason to believe they basically, well, fabricated information on their mortgage application. His dad's letting him know there's just no way they can keep up with the payments. Their financial situation is a mess.
What's interesting here is Bruce's insider knowledge. He's not just looking at publicly available data.
Right.
He has a strong belief based on his father's perspective that the Kellys are very likely headed for foreclosure.
Yeah.
This puts him in a deeply uncomfortable ethical position.
Absolutely. So the Kellys might call Bruce to get insurance for this new house. And Bruce is now grappling with what he should do.
Right.
Does he just sell them a standard policy, no questions asked? Does he try to offer them coverage, but with all sorts of unusual conditions to minimize Ajax's potential losses?
Or refuse.
Or does he just outright refuse to sell them insurance, knowing what he knows?
The source material outlines three distinct paths for Bruce. Routine coverage, coverage with special conditions, or, yeah, outright rejection.
Yeah.
Each of these options carries its own set of ethical implications.
Let's dig into those special conditions for a moment. The material suggests things like requiring them to pay their entire annual premium up front.
Wow.
Instead of breaking it down into monthly payments, or even mandating quarterly safety inspections of their property.
Hmm.
I mean, those kinds of conditions could raise eyebrows for everyone involved.
Exactly. These conditions clearly signal a lack of trust and a perception of higher risk.
Definitely.
But they also raise questions about fairness. Are these conditions genuinely an appropriate way to mitigate the risk, or are they simply a way to penalize the Kellys based on Bruce's suspicions and, well, secondhand information?
And that really brings us to the heart of the ethical puzzle. Who does Bruce owe his primary responsibility to?
Okay.
Is it to himself and earning a living through commissions? Is it to Ajax Insurance to safeguard their financial interests?
Or the Kellys?
Is it to the Kellys who are seeking insurance coverage regardless of their potential financial instability? Or does he have some broader duty to the community to not facilitate what he believes is potentially a fraudulent situation?
Right.
And so the core tension here isn't just about following company policy. It's about navigating competing loyalties, a tightrope walk between profit, responsibility to a potential customer, and perhaps even a broader ethical obligation based on his insider knowledge.
These are the fundamental questions that ethical frameworks are built upon. And as the source material points out, there isn't a single easy answer.
No silver bullet.
Bruce's decision will likely be shaped by his own personal values and how he understands his role as an insurance professional within this specific context of a potential housing issue.
The source even throws in an interesting twist. Could Bruce ethically offer financial counseling to the Kellys, perhaps as a separate service, instead of just selling them insurance?
Oh, interesting.
I mean, that's a really interesting way to potentially serve everyone's best interests, even if it falls outside the traditional role of an insurance agent.
That's a fascinating point. It shifts the focus from simply selling an insurance product to, like, addressing the underlying financial vulnerabilities.
Yep.
It suggests a more comprehensive and perhaps more ethical approach to the situation. But it also raises questions about whether Bruce has the necessary expertise for financial counseling.
Right. Is he qualified?
And whether that falls within his professional responsibilities as an insurance agent.
So the key insight from Bruce's situation is that even when an insurance agent has inside information about a client's potentially shaky financial situation, they face a really complex ethical balancing act with no clear-cut solutions.
Absolutely. And this tension between personal knowledge, professional duty, and broader societal implications continues in our next scenario, which involves the complexities of family relationships.
Ah, yes, the classic Kimon little sister scenario.
Yeah.
This one involves Conrad, who runs an electrical contracting business, and his younger sister, Aggie, who works as an insurance agent for Solid Insurance Company, or SIC. Now, they've got this pretty efficient system going, where Conrad lets Aggie know about each new job he takes on, and she gets him the appropriate insurance coverage through SIC separate policies for each contract, which works out quite well.
This arrangement is both efficient and ensures that each specific project is adequately covered without Conrad needing to rely on potentially insufficient blanket coverage.
Right.
The underwriters at SIC have also developed a level of trust in Aggie's judgment and, you know, the quality of Conrad's electrical work.
But then one Friday afternoon, towards the end of a really hectic month for Conrad, he realizes he completely forgot to tell Aggie about this small kitchen rewiring job he'd just finished up for a church basement.
Oops.
It was a quick, straightforward job, and in Conrad's mind, the risk of anything going wrong was practically zero.
Okay.
So he thinks, why even go through the hassle of getting insurance for it and spending the extra money on the premium?
Conrad's thinking is understandable from a purely cost-saving perspective, especially since the job is already completed and there haven't been any losses.
Yeah, makes sense on the surface.
However, this is where the ethical lines start to become, well, less clear.
Exactly. Now, Aggie, being the observant sister that she is, happens to spot one of Conrad's company trucks parked outside this church.
Uh-oh.
She's a little surprised because he hadn't mentioned the job, so at their regular Saturday family dinner, she brings it up.
Awkward.
Conrad apologizes for the oversight and tries to downplay it, saying it's done, no harm done. Then he tries to smooth things over by offering Aggie his contractor discount on a new big screen TV to make up for her lost commission.
Ah, the kickback.
So little sister, he says, can we just not mention this to SIC now that it's all finished?
The moment Conrad calls her little sister in that way, Aggie's internal alarms start going off.
Right.
She knows her brother and she suspects he might not have been completely forthcoming about all of his jobs over the years.
Mm.
But she decides to focus specifically on this church project.
And she immediately sees several potential problems. First off, from a risk management standpoint, if something does happen down the line related to that electrical work even years later.
Yeah, latency.
Conrad would be personally liable for any claims without insurance coverage.
That's a critical point.
Yeah.
Liability claims can surface long after a project is completed, and without insurance, Conrad's entire business could face significant financial risk.
Secondly, Aggie realizes that if SAC ever finds out that Conrad intentionally didn't report this job, it would completely undermine the trust they have placed in both of them.
Totally.
Even though it wasn't a direct violation of an existing policy, since they get separate policies for each job, it's a significant breach of good faith.
Trust is absolutely essential in the insurance industry. If an insurer can't rely on the accuracy and completeness of the information provided by an agent and their clients, the entire system becomes unstable.
And thirdly, Aggie recognizes this crucial concept of adverse selection. If Conrad believes he can selectively report and pay premiums only for the jobs he considers risky and skip the safe ones, it disrupts the fundamental actuarial science that underpins insurance pricing. The insurer needs a representative sample of all types of risks to accurately determine fair premium levels.
Precisely. If policyholders could pick and choose which risks to insure, only the most hazardous exposures would be covered, leading to unsustainable premium costs for everyone else in the risk pool. Makes total sense.
So, ethically, Aggie understands that she has a primary duty to SIC as their agent.
Right.
That responsibility takes precedence over her loyalty to her brother, even though he's family.
Yeah, that's tough.
She has to report the job. Fiduciary duty to the insurer overrides personal loyalty, and even seemingly minor omissions by a client must be reported to avoid breaching trust and enabling adverse selection.
Even though Conrad tries to argue that it's a wash transaction, since no loss occurred and SA said didn't earn a premium.
Right, no harm, no foul.
Aggie understands that remaining silent would be an ethical failure. It would damage her professional relationship with SIC and allow this instance of adverse selection to go uncorrected.
Right. The ethical course of action for Aggie is to belatedly report the church job, get it insured as if she had known about it from the beginning, and bill Conrad for the standard premium.
Yep.
And Conrad, in the long run, being a responsible brother, should probably just pay it.
This scenario also raises a broader ethical question. Should insurance professionals even market their services to their own relatives?
Oh, yeah. Good point.
The inherent potential for conflicts of interest can create precisely these kinds of difficult situations.
And it doesn't end there. The source throws in another related dilemma. What if Conrad had a property damage claim against SI, and their other sister, Pam, worked as a claims adjuster for SI?
Oh, wow.
Would it be appropriate for Pam to handle Conrad's claim? Would it even matter if Pam and Conrad had a close, loving relationship or a really contentious one?
Yeah.
It really highlights how ethics isn't always a clear black and white issue.
Exactly. These hypotheticals compel us to consider how personal relationships can influence professional judgment and the importance of maintaining impartiality and avoiding even the appearance of a conflict of interest.
Uh-huh.
The key insight here is the delicate balance between personal loyalties and professional responsibilities and the agent's fundamental duty to the insurer.
Okay, so we've looked at some tricky situations for individual agents. Now let's step back and consider the bigger picture. The evolving landscape of insurance. It feels like things are changing very quickly.
It certainly does. The traditional model of insurance has always been based on the concept of individual uncertainty, but the collective predictability of losses.
Right, the law of large numbers.
Exactly. You can't know for sure if your own home will be damaged by fire. But statistically, insurers can predict with reasonable accuracy how many homes within a large pool of insured properties will experience a fire in a given year.
But when you look at recent events, the increasing frequency of major natural disasters, the ongoing threat of terrorism, the growing and, well, undeniable concerns about global warming.
Yeah.
It feels like the predictability part of that equation is becoming much more challenging.
Precisely. These kinds of events are really putting pressure on those traditional insurance models.
How so?
We're seeing more frequent and more intense hurricanes, floods, and wildfires. Terrorism has become a significant risk that needs to be insured against.
Right.
And the potential long-term effects of global warming are creating significant uncertainties for insurers. These unpredictable events make it harder for actuaries to accurately forecast losses based on historical data, which is, you know, the cornerstone of traditional insurance pricing.
And the insurance industry is responding. We're seeing insurance premiums skyrocket in certain areas prone to these events.
Mm-hmm.
Insurers refusing to renew policies unless homeowners take pretty significant loss mitigation measures. And even some companies deciding to withdraw from entire geographic markets.
In response, policyholders are understandably feeling frustrated and are putting pressure on government officials to intervene and demand that insurers continue to provide coverage at, well, previous rates.
Yeah, keep it affordable.
Regardless of the potential financial strain on the insurance companies themselves.
Which leads us to two really critical questions raised in the material. Is our world undergoing a fundamental, permanent shift in terms of the types and severity of insurable risks?
Big question.
And if that's the case, what should we as a society do to address it?
The evidence of such a shift is certainly accumulating. We've seen the data on the increasing frequency and intensity of extreme weather events.
For sure.
Terrorism insurance is now a standard consideration in many sectors. The scientific consensus on global warming is very strong.
Right.
And perhaps most tellingly, we've observed significant increases in property insurance premiums in many regions, suggesting that insurers themselves recognize a heightened level of risk.
It almost feels like some insurers might be overreacting a little, trying to rapidly build up their catastrophe reserves instead of taking a longer-term, more strategic approach.
Maybe.
Potentially undermining the entire system with these massive premium increases.
There's certainly a risk of short-sighted reactions. And the source material also points out how politically motivated demands for quick solutions, things like mandating changes in policy language or premium rates, can actually undermine the fundamental principles of how insurance should operate effectively over the long term.
So, what are some potential ways forward? The material suggests a few interesting possibilities. One is for insurers to proactively help policyholders finance those necessary safety upgrades.
Oh, like loans.
Offering low-interest loans for things like those more resilient roofs in hurricane-prone areas, for example.
That's a proactive strategy that could benefit everyone involved. Insurers would reduce their potential future losses, and homeowners would gain the necessary upgrades to maintain their coverage and potentially lower their long-term insurance costs. Makes sense.
Another idea is for governments to offer tax credits to policyholders who invest in loss control measures.
Incentivize it.
That would help spread the cost of risk reduction across society as a whole, rather than solely burdening the insured individuals and the insurance industry.
And finally, the material suggests that insurers could play a more active role in advocating for long-term changes in zoning regulations.
Like where people can build.
Things like restricting building in areas with a high probability of repeated catastrophic events or mandating specific loss control measures in high-risk zones.
That makes sense. I mean, if we have clear data showing that an area is highly likely to be hit by a major hurricane every few years, is it truly ethical to continue insuring and rebuilding there without implementing some significant changes?
Ultimately, the source material emphasizes that insurers have not only a right, but a fundamental duty to resist drastic, poorly considered changes that could undermine the core principles of insurance.
HR.
Fair, adequate, and reasonable premiums and efficient operations. Insurance is a long-term undertaking, and short-sighted responses can have severe consequences down the road.
It brings up the tension between a sky is falling mentality and the underlying logic of insurance, which has successfully navigated numerous challenges throughout its history.
Right.
And it underscores the courage required to resist pressures for quick fixes that might seem appealing in the short term, but could seriously damage the industry's ability to function effectively in the future.
The historical examples of Hurricane Katrina and the FAIR plans from the 1960s illustrate this point. It's essential to adjust local and regional premiums to accurately reflect the actual local and regional losses. Halton standard claims adjustment procedures, as unfortunately happened after Katrina, can actually impede the recovery process.
And it comes back to that ethical consideration of not rebuilding in extremely high-risk areas like the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans without those significantly higher premiums that truly reflect the level of hazard.
Exactly. Aligning the price with the risk simply makes more ethical sense in the long run.
So the key insight here is the ethical responsibility of the insurance industry to maintain its stability and function effectively in the face of these evolving risks, carefully balancing the immediate needs of policyholders with the long-term sustainability of core insurance principles.
Well put.
Now let's switch gears a bit and discuss something that can really damage that foundation of trust we talked about earlier, what the material refers to as insurance industry gimmicks.
What's interesting here is how certain actions that might seem logical or justifiable from an actuarial or legal perspective within the industry can completely puzzle and frustrate the general public. And when that happens, it erodes the very trust upon which the entire system of insurance depends.
The first example highlighted is this really controversial practice that some insurers attempted after Hurricane Katrina, reclassifying hurricane-related damage as flood damage.
Oh, I remember that.
In order to deny wind damage claims, because most standard homeowners' policies explicitly exclude flood damage. I mean, talk about a way to enrage your policyholders who had just experienced a devastating event.
It's a prime example of how trying to exploit the specific wording of a policy in a way that appears disingenuous can backfire spectacularly.
Right.
It directly contradicts that fundamental principle of utmost good faith that the insurance industry has historically been built upon. Even federal courts took insurers to task for engaging in this kind of practice.
Then there's the more recent trend of using credit scores as a factor in adjusting driver insurance premiums.
Right, that's a big one.
Now, the insurers have their rationale, arguing that there's a statistical correlation between lower credit scores and a higher likelihood of filing insurance claims.
And statistically, their claim is often accurate. Individuals with lower credit scores are, as a group, more likely to file insurance claims.
Oh.
However, the crucial distinction that often gets lost is that there's no direct evidence to suggest that drivers with lower credit scores are actually more dangerous drivers.
Ah, okay. So it's about filing claims, not causing accidents necessarily.
Exactly. They're simply more likely to file a claim for an accident they do have, possibly because they have fewer financial resources to cover minor damage out of pocket.
Exactly. So to the average person, it just feels like another way for insurance companies to charge more money, particularly from those who are already facing financial challenges.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's genuinely about predicting driving safety. Exploiting a policy language or using non-risk-based factors for premiums, even if technically legal, erodes the fundamental trust of insurance and invites regulatory scrutiny.
The core question here is whether industry leaders truly understand or even care about how policyholders perceive these kinds of practices.
Right.
When people feel like they're being taken advantage of or that the rules are being manipulated in a way that isn't transparent, it breeds significant distrust.
And as the material points out, when that public trust erodes, regulatory bodies tend to step in, as we saw in Florida after those hurricane claim denials.
Yep. Regulation often follows public outcry.
This kind of intervention can lead to much greater regulatory oversight, which ultimately might not be the outcome the insurance industry desires.
The call here is for a return to clear, straightforward language in insurance policies and rating procedures that the public can readily understand.
Makes sense.
Fostering trust and better communication rather than relying on practices that can easily be perceived as deceptive or unfair.
Now, another practice that raises some serious ethical questions is the whole concept of accident forgiveness.
Ah, yeah. The marketing sounds good.
It sounds great at first glance, right? You're involved in an at-fault accident and your insurance company just forgives it, doesn't raise your rates.
Seems like a perk.
But is it really that simple? And more importantly, is it actually fair to all policyholders?
That's the central issue. While accident forgiveness can be an effective marketing tool to attract and retain customers, when you examine it through the lens of fundamental insurance principles and ethical considerations, it presents some real problems.
The material presents a scenario involving three drivers, Johanna, Jeff, and Lillian, who are all involved in a multi-car accident where each of them was found to be partially at fault.
Okay.
However, they have different insurance arrangements when it comes to accident forgiveness.
How so?
Johanna proactively purchased accident forgiveness as an additional feature on her insurance policy. Jeff received it for free as an incentive for being a new customer.
Okay.
And Lillian's insurance company doesn't offer accident forgiveness at all.
Got it. Three different setups.
And this scenario really highlights how accident forgiveness can potentially violate those core insurance principles we discussed earlier. The need for adequate rates, reasonable rates, and rates that are not unfairly discriminatory.
Uh-huh.
While marketed as a benefit, accident forgiveness can unfairly burden safe drivers and destabilize the insurance pool by masking the true cost of risk.
Exactly. If insurer A sells accident forgiveness, the premium Johanna paid for it likely averages out the cost of forgiving a certain number of accidents across all policyholders who purchase it. But since Johanna have a clean driving record, she is likely overpaying, effectively subsidizing those drivers who are statistically more likely to be involved in accidents. Insurer C, by not offering accident forgiveness, adheres to more traditional rating methods, which, while not without their flaws, arguably provide a more stable and equitable foundation for premium calculation.
And then there's insurer B, which offers accident forgiveness for free.
The free one.
The significant risk here is that if drivers with less than perfect driving histories, who are naturally attracted to this free benefit, don't improve their driving habits, Insurer B's total premium income may not be sufficient to cover the increased number of claims. This could then force them to raise premiums for everyone, including safer drivers like Ioana.
So offering free accident forgiveness can create a negative cycle of insufficient premium income and unfairness among policyholders.
Sounds like it.
Even offering limited forgiveness, where only a certain number of accidents are forgiven, still carries the same fundamental ethical flaws related to cross-subsidization.
Ultimately, the material argues that accident forgiveness negatively impacts two main groups. The majority of insured individuals who end up paying higher overall rates for coverage that might become less financially secure.
Right, the safer drivers.
And the insurers, stockholders, and creditors who could see lower returns due to inadequate premium income.
It really comes down to the principle of fair risk sharing. Accident forgiveness essentially exempts those who cause more insurance losses from bearing their proportionate share of the cost. Unfairly increasing the burden on those who are relatively accident-free. The term forgiveness itself can be somewhat misleading, as it implies a gratuitous act rather than a fundamental shift in how risk is priced and distributed.
Let's move on to a really challenging situation. How an insurance claims manager makes decisions about which claims to prioritize in the aftermath of a major disaster.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's tough.
This scenario involves Grant Solomon at ABC Insurance following a tornado that devastates the town of Toto, Kansas.
This scenario perfectly illustrates the ethical dilemmas that arise when resources are stretched thin and multiple individuals and entities have equally valid legal rights to have their insurance claims processed. It's triage, basically.
Grant is faced with three significant claims. Toto General Hospital, which is the only trauma center in the area and a major local employer.
Critical infrastructure.
St. Tristan's Community Center, the sole community charity providing vital support services. And Garland's Famous Restaurant, a beloved local landmark and a key part of the town's identity.
Wow, all important.
All three have sustained substantial damage.
Grant understands that his team has limited capacity and cannot effectively handle all three complex claims simultaneously.
Right.
He also recognizes that he can't simply base his decision on which claimant has the greatest immediate need, as all three provide essential services to the devastated community.
So what does he do?
He finds himself grappling with the philosophical principle of trying to do the greatest good for the greatest number.
So he begins to analyze each case. The hospital seems like the most obvious priority, right? It's critical for saving lives and a major source of local jobs.
You'd think so.
However, it's also a very large and complex claim that would likely tie up his adjusters for an extended period. And surprisingly, a hospital in a neighboring city has temporarily stepped in to handle the overflow of patients.
Ah, okay. So maybe not as immediately critical as it first appears.
Then there's the community center, which is desperately needed to provide shelter and support for those who have lost their homes.
Huge need there.
Getting it back up and running quickly could significantly boost community morale and aid in the recovery efforts. However, it also has a small staff and will require a considerable effort to assess and process the claim.
Right. Resource intensive.
And finally, there is Garland's Famous Restaurant. Repairing the damage, primarily a roof collapse, is a relatively straightforward process compared to the other two claims.
Simpler fix.
It's also a highly visible symbol of the town's identity and a significant local business. Getting it reopened quickly could provide a much-needed economic boost and a sense of normalcy for the community.
Hmm.
And this is the claim that Grant is leaning towards prioritizing.
The restaurant. Interesting. Why?
Grant's rationale is that by focusing on the restaurant first, while it may not directly save lives in the immediate aftermath, it offers a highly visible sign of recovery and can quickly inject some economic activity and a sense of hope back into the community.
Ah, the symbolic value.
It's a pragmatic decision with significant symbolic value.
This scenario really forces us to consider the ethical dimensions of allocating limited resources in a crisis situation.
Definitely.
When everyone has a legitimate insurance claim, how do you weigh competing community needs and the practicalities of claims adjustment to arrive at the most ethical decision?
It highlights that Ethical decision-making in a business context often involves navigating difficult trade-offs and considering the broader impact of decisions beyond just the immediate contractual obligations to individual policyholders.
Yeah, it's not just about the policy language sometimes.
Now, this next scenario is a bit of a legal and ethical puzzle. It involves, just in case, the risk manager for Smithfield Homes, a company that develops houses on private islands. Yeah. And it all hinges on the significance of what seems like a very small amount of money, $100.
$100.
Yeah.
This is going to be interesting. This is a compelling case study in how seemingly minor details can have significant ramifications for insurance coverage and ethical responsibilities.
So picture this. Two prospective buyers, a father and son named Sam and Junior Warbucks, are visiting a Smithfield development.
Mm-hmm.
They're eager to get a closer look at one of the islands, so they persuade a Smithfield foreman to take them on a private, unscheduled sunrise boat trip.
Okay, impromptu trip.
The foreman gets informal permission from a sales representative, though it's unclear if that rep had the authority to grant it.
Crucially, the foreman mistakenly believes that the 20-foot outboard boat he uses is owned by Smithfield, but it's actually abandoned property. And without anyone else at Smithfield initially knowing, he asks Sam Warbucks for $100 in cash for the trip and requests that he keep the payment confidential.
Shady.
Sam agrees and pays the $100.
Tragically, on their way to the island, the foreman is involved in a boating accident, and both Sam and Junior Warbucks are killed.
That's terrible.
The foreman survives, but sustains serious injuries. When just in case the risk manager learns about this, his immediate concerns revolve around workers' compensation for the injured foreman and commercial general liability, CGL, for the likely wrongful death lawsuits from the Warbucks family.
Big liability exposure.
He notes that Smithfield doesn't have ocean marine insurance and has limited umbrella coverage.
Justin initially focuses on Smithfield's CGL policy, which contains an exclusion for bodily injury arising out of the use of watercraft owned by the insured.
Okay.
However, there is an exception to this exclusion for non-owned watercraft under 26 feet in length, provided they are not used to carry persons for a charge.
The no charge clause.
Based on the information Justin has at this point that the boat wasn't owned by Smithfield, it appears that the CGL policy should provide coverage for the liability claims.
So Justin informs the workers' compensation insurer that the foreman's claim might be problematic and even suggests that the foreman seek legal counsel.
Okay.
He also prepares Smithfield's CGL insurer for the anticipated liability claims, operating under the assumption that the non-owned, no-charge exception applies since he is unaware of the $100 payment.
Justin believes he is fulfilling his responsibilities, balancing his duty to protect Smithfield with their overarching obligation of utmost good faith to their insurance providers.
Seems reasonable so far.
But then, about 6 weeks later, he visits the injured foreman during his rehabilitation, and the foreman casually mentions to Justin that Sam Warbucks had given him $100 for the boat ride, saying he felt bad for not providing a better experience.
Uh-oh. There it is. And that's the crucial piece of information. Suddenly, that no-charge condition of the CGL policy exception might no longer be met.
Right. That $100 changes everything.
The CGL insurer could now have a valid basis to deny coverage, potentially leaving Smithfield exposed to a multi-million dollar lawsuit, possibly as much as $10 million.
Justin now faces a significant ethical dilemma. He has a duty of utmost good faith to the CGL insurer to disclose this newly discovered information.
But,
however, doing so could have devastating financial consequences for Smithfield and its shareholders.
So Justin begins to rationalize the situation. Perhaps the foreman won't mention the $100 payment again.
Maybe sweep it under the rug.
The policy language doesn't specifically state who has to pay or who has to benefit from the charge, only that a charge occurred. He's contemplating remaining silent to protect Smithfield's interests.
Ooh, risky.
This is a classic ethical dilemma where Justin's duty of loyalty to his employer seems to clash directly with the duty of utmost good faith to the insurer.
The source material strongly advocates for full and transparent disclosure to all parties involved as the most ethical and, in the long run, the safest course of action.
Why safest?
Withholding such a significant fact could have severe negative repercussions for Justin's professional reputation and for Smithfield's future insurability if it comes out later. And things like this often do.
It really underscores how even a seemingly insignificant detail like that $100 payment can completely unravel an insurance coverage situation and create a major ethical crisis for the risk manager involved.
Absolutely. And it emphasizes the fundamental importance of transparency and honesty in all dealings with insurance providers. It's that utmost good faith thing again.
Okay, so we've examined some pretty complex ethical scenarios, but where do our ethical principles even originate? I mean, it's not as if we're born with a fully formed moral code.
That's absolutely correct. Our understanding of right and wrong is shaped by a multitude of influences throughout our lives.
Yeah.
The source material provides a really insightful overview of these various sources.
It starts with our upbringing during childhood, the lessons our parents consciously teach us, as well as the values and behaviors they model through their own actions.
Right, those early foundations.
These early experiences really lay the groundwork for our fundamental beliefs about what is right and wrong.
Then, as we go through life, our later experiences, significant events and interactions, can consciously or unconsciously shape our ethical perspectives.
How so?
For instance, someone who has a positive experience with their insurance company after suffering a major loss might develop a very different view of the industry compared to someone who feels they were treated unfairly during the claims process.
Makes sense. For many people, religious beliefs play a very significant role in shaping their ethics, often providing clear and consistent guidelines for personal conduct that can often be directly applied to business situations as well.
Professional codes of ethics also serve as a direct and explicit source of guidance, outlining core objectives like honesty and service to the public, and often providing specific rules of conduct for individuals working in a particular industry.
And we shouldn't overlook the influence of social consensus, our everyday conversations and interactions with family, friends, and colleagues.
Just talking things through.
Where we constantly discuss and evaluate the actions of others, which in turn shapes our own sense of what is considered acceptable behavior within our communities.
In contrast to these more informal influences, we also have the principles developed by ethical philosophers over centuries.
Right, the big thinkers.
These often fall into broad categories like rule-based ethics, where the focus is on adhering to specific rules or duties, such as, you know, the Ten Commandments, or results-based ethics, which emphasize the outcomes of actions, such as the principle of the greatest good for the greatest number, utilitarianism.
Finally, the material highlights the value of considering ethical dilemmas, those tricky situations where different ethical principles seem to clash.
Ah, the thought experiments.
Thinking through these scenarios, even if they are hypothetical, can significantly enhance our ethical awareness and help us understand different ethical viewpoints.
Yeah, like what?
The classic example of the child harboring an escaped convict father and the conflict between family loyalty and the duty to tell the truth illustrates this well.
These dilemmas force us to confront competing values and to consider which ethical principles should take precedence in different contexts.
Right.
It's a critical way to develop our ethical reasoning abilities. The key insight here is that our ethics are a complex mix of various influences, and understanding these sources can help us navigate ethical disagreements and strengthen our own moral compass.
Now, let's delve into another intricate ethical situation involving Justin Case. This one is titled, The Offer Justin Couldn't Ethically Accept.
Okay, another one for Justin.
It sounds like a real test of his principles.
It is indeed. Justin, being a responsible insurance broker, wants his clients to prioritize safety.
Makes sense.
So he's initially pleased when his friend Bob, who owns Omega Refuse, offers him a $1,000 monthly retainer, in addition to his regular commissions, simply to keep Bob informed about the latest innovations in fire safety for his newly rebuilt facility.
Okay.
Which had unfortunately burned down the previous year.
That sounds like a mutually beneficial arrangement, right? Bob gets valuable safety information and Justin earns some additional income.
Seems okay on the surface.
But of course, there's a significant condition attached. Bob explicitly insists that Justin cannot share this fire safety knowledge with anyone.
Ah, there's the catch.
And especially not with his fierce business competitor, Frank, who owns Alpha Garbage Services.
Bob's reasoning is that the retainer effectively makes this new fire safety knowledge his exclusive proprietary information, at least in relation to Justin's other clients, particularly Frank, who is a direct competitor.
And immediately, Justin recognizes a whole host of ethical problems with this offer.
Like what?
First and foremost, Frank is also Justin's client, and Justin has a professional responsibility to share important safety information with him.
Right. duty to all clients.
Second, Justin feels a broader ethical duty to the entire community to not withhold information that could potentially prevent fires and endanger the town.
Yeah, public safety.
And third, the insurance company that provides coverage for both Omega and Alpha arguably also has a legitimate need to be aware of this crucial safety information.
Mm-hmm.
Justin recognizes that accepting Bob's offer would put him in a clear conflict of interest, forcing him to potentially withhold vital information from other parties who have a legitimate need for it.
Yeah, that's a big conflict. Accepting Bob's offer would put him in a clear conflict of interest, forcing him to potentially withhold vital information from other parties who have a legitimate need for it.
But simply rejecting Bob's offer outright also presents potential downsides. Bob might revert to less safe practices regarding fire prevention, sure, potentially endangering his business and the wider community. It also wouldn't necessarily be in the best interests of the insurance carrier or other policyholders who might ultimately bear the financial burden of future fires. Mm. And it could potentially discourage Bob from seeking out any risk management improvements in the future.
So Justin finds himself in a genuine ethical bind. He cannot ethically accept the offer as it is structured, but simply refusing it entirely isn't an ideal solution either.
What can he do?
The material suggests a few potential alternative approaches, such as Justin declining the retainer, but still offering to share his research findings freely with both Bob and Frank. Or perhaps recommending a specialized fire safety consultant to both businesses, thereby removing Justin from the direct conflict.
That third option, exploring alternative ways to manage conflicting client interests concerning potentially proprietary information, leads to a more fundamental question. Is risk management expertise something that should be treated as a competitive advantage, or is it more of a community good?
That's a really important question about the nature of professional knowledge and responsibility.
Yeah.
If Justin were to independently learn about new significant fire safety measures, or if Frank were to develop his own proprietary safety information, what would Justin's ethical obligations be then?
Good question.
Should he, for example, encourage Frank to make his findings more widely available, as the expert personally believes would be the most ethically sound approach?
This scenario really underscores the ethical tightrope walk that risk management professionals often navigate when they have to balance the competing interests of different clients and their broader responsibilities to the community, especially when dealing with knowledge that could potentially save lives, and the concept of proprietary information.
It highlights the fact that ethical decision-making in this field often requires creative problem-solving and a careful consideration of the wider societal implications of one's professional actions.
This naturally leads us to a really fundamental question. Do risk management professionals, by virtue of their specialized knowledge and skills, have a particular ethical duty to act?
Uh-huh.
Perhaps similar to the ethical obligations we associate with professions like medicine or firefighting.
That's a crucial point to consider. Society often places a certain level of expectation on individuals with unique expertise.
Right.
Anticipating that they will step forward in emergency situations or utilize their knowledge for the benefit of others, even if it extends beyond their formal job responsibilities.
We see this with doctors in medical emergencies, clergy offering comfort, lawyers advocating for justice, and firefighters and police officers often responding even when they are off duty.
Right. There seems to be an inherent sense of professional obligation that goes beyond the specific confines of their employment.
However, many risk management professionals might understandably want to limit their professional obligations primarily to their employers, clients, or those they directly insure.
Yeah, keep it within bounds.
The question then becomes, does their specialized understanding of potential hazards and their mitigation create a broader ethical responsibility that extends beyond these defined relationships?
The expert whose work informs this deep dive argues that it does.
Really?
This specialized knowledge of risk management, they contend, creates a distinct ethical duty to take action in situations involving extreme uncontrolled hazards.
Yep.
Provided that such action doesn't violate other primary duties or create even greater dangers.
So it's not just about volunteering.
It's about more than just volunteering in safe, structured environments.
Yeah.
It's about having the courage to step forward when your expertise allows you to see potential crises looming that others don't recognize or can't handle.
Mm-hmm. The material provides a compelling fire safety case study to illustrate this point. A risk manager working for a clothing wholesaler observes alarmingly poor fire safety practices at a neighboring paint manufacturing facility.
Okay.
Even though the wholesaler has implemented its own comprehensive fire safety measures to protect its own property and employees, does this risk manager have a further ethical obligation to the other businesses and occupants within the industrial park and to the park's management?
The argument presented is that they do have a responsibility, stemming from their specialized knowledge about fire hazards and effective control measures, knowledge that the others in the industrial park likely lack.
So what should they do?
Ethical actions in such a situation could involve proactively building relationships with the neighboring business, gradually educating them on basic fire safety principles, and perhaps even guiding them towards resources or recognition for making improvements.
And this seemingly altruistic effort can actually benefit the wholesaler as well by contributing to a safer overall environment within the industrial park.
Right, enlightened self-interest.
Thereby reducing the likelihood of a fire spreading and impacting their own operations. It's a situation where acting ethically can also lead to practical benefits.
Ultimately, this section challenges risk management professionals to think beyond the immediate boundaries of their professional roles and consider their broader ethical responsibilities, suggesting a duty to share their expertise to help mitigate risks within the wider community, even when there's no direct contractual obligation to do so.
This brings us to the central theme that really ties everything we've discussed together, the deeply intertwined nature of ethics and risk management.
Yes.
It's not simply that they are related disciplines. They are fundamentally dependent on each other.
Exactly. Effective risk management absolutely requires a strong foundation of good ethics. And conversely, a commitment to good ethical conduct necessitates the application of sound risk management principles.
Like two sides of a coin?
They are truly two sides of the same coin.
On the positive side, ethical behavior is absolutely essential for effective risk management. If individuals and organizations aren't operating with honesty and integrity, it becomes virtually impossible to accurately assess and manage potential risks.
Right. Garbage in, garbage out.
And by the same token, robust risk management practices are crucial for ensuring ethical organizational behavior by proactively minimizing potential harms and negative consequences. Organizations can operate more responsibly towards all of their stakeholders.
Conversely, unethical actions can completely undermine even the most well-intentioned risk management efforts, potentially leading to unforeseen losses, liabilities, and reputational damage.
Yeah, makes sense.
And it's also true that poor risk management itself can be considered unethical, as it can unnecessarily expose individuals and organizations to preventable dangers and harm.
The material defines risk management as a systematic process aimed at minimizing the adverse effects of potential losses, and ethics as a framework of guidelines for appropriate conduct towards others. It emphasizes that both disciplines share a fundamental goal, fostering respect for the rights, safety, and independence of others.
And the examples we've discussed really illustrate this interconnectedness. Consider how unethical product misrepresentation can lead directly to significant liability claims and damage to an organization's reputation.
Right. Bad risk management.
Clear failure of risk management. Or how the unethical treatment of employees can result in decreased morale, potential legal issues, and even the exploitation of the employer through internal risks.
Like theft?
The failure to report employee theft is both unethical and a lapse in basic risk management. Improper disposal of hazardous waste is not only unethical, but can lead to costly lawsuits and environmental fines.
Right.
And finally, dishonest reporting of information to insurers in an attempt to secure lower premiums is both an unethical practice and a short-sighted risk management strategy that jeopardizes long-term insurance coverage.
It all comes back to the idea that good risk management and good ethics are not just desirable ideals. They are mutually supportive and absolutely essential for the long-term well-being, sustainability, and responsible operation of any organization, regardless of its size or industry.
Indeed. They are inextricably linked and reinforce each other in critical ways. You can't really have one without the other long-term.
Now, let's delve into a really personal ethical dilemma framed as the personal and professional risks of approving PAM. This one seems to hit very close to home for the listener.
This scenario explores a deeply human ethical question. Should an employer, particularly in a personal care setting, permit an employee to knowingly take significant personal risks in order to fulfill their job responsibilities, even if it could potentially benefit both parties?
The situation involves the listener, George, who requires daily personal care assistance. He relies on an agency called Apex to provide aids, But finding and retaining reliable help is a constant challenge.
Yeah, I hear that stuff.
Then he meets Pam, a potential new aide who possesses the necessary skills but faces significant obstacles related to transportation and childcare for evening work.
Okay, so she's qualified but has logistical issues.
Pam proposes a solution. She would bring her 3-year-old child with her on public transportation and then walk across a busy highway, often after dark, to reach George's apartment.
Wow. With a toddler. Across the highway.
The most direct route across the highway is quite dangerous, and even the slightly safer alternative would involve a considerable amount of walking along a heavily trafficked road with a young child.
So George finds himself deeply conflicted. As someone with a background in risk management, alarm bells are going off regarding the safety risk for both Pam and her young daughter, as well as his own potential liability.
Yeah, big time.
However, as an individual who desperately needs reliable care, he also feels a strong sense of empathy for Pam's difficult circumstances and her need to work.
The core ethical issue at the heart of this dilemma is whether Pam has the right to knowingly undertake these significant personal risks, and perhaps more importantly, to potentially endanger her young child.
Right, so the child didn't choose this.
In order to secure employment and financial gain. It's a classic ethical conflict where competing values and potential harms and benefits on both sides must be carefully weighed.
George ultimately makes the difficult decision to reject Pam's proposal.
Okay.
And his primary reasoning centers on the potential endangerment of her daughter, who, at such a young age, has no agency or choice in the matter.
Right.
He feels that neither he nor Pam have the ethical right to place her in such a demonstrably dangerous situation.
George also considers the broader implications of his decision, observing that in most workplace environments, when an employee takes on excessive personal risks, it often creates added dangers for others as well.
Ripple effects.
He raises the point that the ethical entitlement to take personal risks might only be justifiable if it doesn't negatively impact the safety and well-being of others, a condition that is rarely met in real-world scenarios.
The scenario concludes with a powerful reflection on the idea that within the larger family of a workplace or community, there is a shared responsibility to look out for one another's well-being.
Yeah.
It's a deeply personal example of how fundamental ethical considerations can and should sometimes override even pressing practical needs and desires. It highlights the moral responsibility of an employer to consider the safety and well-being of their employees, especially when vulnerable individuals are involved.
Definitely a tough one. Okay, as we approach the end of our in-depth exploration today, we need to address a really crucial area. The specific standards of conduct that apply to insurance producers.
Right. What are the rules of the road?
What are the formal and informal rules and expectations that govern how these professionals are supposed to act in their roles?
This is a critical area because, as we saw in the case of the Leonards lawsuit following Hurricane Katrina, clearly defining the expected standard of care for insurance agents can be surprisingly challenging.
Uh-huh.
Particularly when it comes to providing advice on complex topics like flood insurance.
Right.
In that particular case, the court actually found no evidence of agent misrepresentation, partly because there was a lack of clear testimony establishing what the prevailing standard of care for agents should have been in that situation.
So where do we even begin to look to understand what those standards of conduct are for insurance producers?
Good question.
The material points to several key sources, decisions made in previous court cases, case law, the internal procedure manuals of the insurance companies themselves.
Right, the company rules.
The specific requirements for obtaining and maintaining an insurance license, and the various codes of ethics established by professional organizations.
Let's start with the initial step of obtaining a license, what we can think of as the occupational standards of entry. In most states, prospective insurance producers are required to complete a certain amount of pre-licensing education.
What does that cover?
This education covers a wide range of essential topics, from the fundamental principles of insurance and relevant state regulations to different types of insurance contracts, basic legal concepts like torts, the various forms of insurance policies available, an overview of the insurance industry itself, underwriting principles, ethical sales practices, and the key features of insurance contracts.
Seems comprehensive.
These pre-licensing courses often place a significant emphasis on the fundamental concept of utmost good faith that underpins the insurance relationship.
And it doesn't stop once someone gets their license. Most states also have ongoing continuing education requirements that producers must meet in order to maintain their licenses.
Right. Got to stay current.
These continuing education courses often cover topics such as effective sales techniques, the specific duties and responsibilities of an insurance agent, how to build and maintain positive client relationships, and very importantly, ethical considerations, including practical strategies for avoiding errors and omissions that could lead to legal liability.
Then we have what we can call the standards of retention, the specific reasons and circumstances under which an insurance producer could actually have their license suspended or revoked.
Okay, what gets them in trouble?
The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, NAIC, Producer Licensing Model Act, provides a comprehensive overview of these grounds for disciplinary action.
Such as?
These include things like intentionally misrepresenting the terms or benefits of insurance policies or applications, engaging in unfair trade practices or outright fraud, and demonstrating a lack of competence, trustworthiness, or financial responsibility.
The examples of intentional misrepresentation are particularly revealing, ranging from the well-known vanishing premium scandals in life insurance.
Oh yeah, those are bad.
Simply providing inaccurate or misleading advice about what a particular policy actually covers. Even failing to recommend a clearly needed and relevant coverage, such as liquor liability insurance for a bar owner, could potentially be viewed as misrepresentation by omission or silence.
Right.
And then, of course, there are the clearly unethical and illegal practices like offering illegal inducements or rebates, engaging in twisting, inducing a client to switch policies based on misrepresentations, and disseminating false or misleading advertising.
The standard of being incompetent, untrustworthy, or financially irresponsible is intentionally broad, allowing state insurance regulators to apply general community standards of ethical and professional conduct to the actions of insurance producers.
Okay.
And naturally, any violation of applicable state or federal insurance laws or regulations can also lead to disciplinary action against a producer's license.
That covers a lot of ground.
It encompasses a surprisingly wide array of legal areas, from IPA and the Risk Retention Act to laws governing retirement plans, securities, and taxation as they relate to insurance products, TIA, FCRA, CAN-SPAM, Gramm-Leach-Bliley concerning financial privacy, the ACA.
Wow.
And specific regulations governing transportation, flood, crop, long-term care, Medicare, and Medicaid insurance. It also includes regulations related to advertising, policy replacement, claims handling, the activities of unauthorized insurers, managing general agents, and even concerns related to professional conduct on social media.
And we shouldn't forget the important role played by the various codes of ethics established and promoted by different professional insurance organizations.
Right, like the CPCU code.
Such as the American Institute for Chartered Property Casualty Underwriters, AICPCU, the National Association of Health Underwriters, NAHU, the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of America, IIABA, and the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, NAIFA, as well as the internal codes of conduct that many individual insurance companies and agencies are now implementing.
That's right.
Furthermore, earning respected professional designations within the insurance industry, such as the CPCU, AAI, CIC, CLU, CHFC, or ARM,
the alphabet soup,
can signify a higher level of expertise and potentially imply a commitment to a higher standard of ethical conduct.
The overarching insight here is that insurance licensees are expected to be much more than just salespeople.
Right.
A purely transactional, sales-focused approach significantly increases the likelihood of errors and omissions that can lead to professional liability.
Uh-huh.
These various legal, regulatory, and professional standards clearly establish that producers have a fundamental responsibility to act with a high degree of knowledge, integrity, and a primary focus on understanding and meeting the needs of their clients.
This brings us to a really interesting and ongoing debate within the insurance industry. The question of whether insurance producers should actually be considered true professionals in a formal legal sense.
Ah, the P-word.
It's a term that is used quite liberally within the industry itself.
It is indeed. You see the term insurance professional used very frequently. However, when you examine the strict legal definitions of a profession and the interpretations provided by the courts,
yeah,
the classification of insurance producers isn't always so straightforward.
The material points out that standard dictionary definitions of a profession typically emphasize the need for prolonged and specialized training, formal qualifications often requiring advanced intellectual skills, and frequently involve a significant level of formal education.
Right, like doctors, lawyers.
Think of fields like medicine, law, or engineering.
And courts, when they have specifically addressed this issue, have often been hesitant to categorize insurance agents as true professionals under the law.
Why is that?
They frequently cite a perceived lack of the same rigorous and lengthy training requirements, the absence of a truly enforceable code of conduct that extends beyond general market norms and ethical considerations, and the fact that insurance agents typically do not have a full fiduciary relationship with their clients in most jurisdictions. Instead, they generally owe a duty of reasonable care, skill, and diligence.
The Florida Supreme Court, in one particular case highlighted in the material, even explicitly stated that a profession typically requires a minimum of a 4-year university degree in a specifically related field of study.
Wow, that's a high bar.
So the prevailing judicial view tends to be that insurance producers, while possessing valuable expertise, may not entirely meet the criteria to be classified as full legal professionals.
The implications of this judicial perspective are quite significant. For one, producers who actively advertise themselves as insurance professionals could potentially be seen as engaging in deceptive or misleading advertising.
Really?
It might even suggest that using terms like customer rather than client could more accurately reflect the legal nature of the relationship as defined by the courts.
Interesting.
Which is often seen as more of an arm's length transaction rather than a deeply fiduciary relationship.
And conversely, if a producer does explicitly claim to be a professional, they might be held to that higher standard of conduct and expertise in the marketplace.
Right. You claim it, you own it.
Regardless of whether the courts officially recognize them as a legal profession, this creates a potential discrepancy between how the industry views itself and how it is viewed legally.
There's a real disconnect here. The insurance industry's own literature and training materials often portray agents as highly knowledgeable risk management advisors with significant duties and responsibilities towards their clients.
Uh-huh.
Going far beyond simply selling insurance policies. Yet the judicial view often seems to understate or cheapen that role and its status.
Yeah.
It raises the fundamental question of whether judges fully understand the complexities and the level of expertise and expectations that exist within the modern insurance industry.
Right.
And the potential for significant financial harm that can result from the actions of ill-equipped or negligent agents.
The dissenting opinion in the Pierce case, which focused on the specific act done by the agent in the use of their superior insurance knowledge, really highlights this fundamental difference in perspective between the judicial system and the insurance industry itself.
Yeah, that dissent was interesting.
It suggests that if an agent is providing advice and utilizing specialized knowledge for the benefit of a client, they should be held to a higher standard of care, regardless of their formal title or educational background.
The idea of fully transitioning to a fiduciary standard for all insurance producers, where they would be legally obligated to always act in the absolute best interests of their clients, has truly staggering implications for the industry, potentially creating inherent conflicts with the interests of the insurance companies they represent.
Huge conflict.
It's a complex issue with a great deal of ongoing debate surrounding it. Ultimately, this ongoing discussion underscores the tension between the industry's aspirations for greater professional recognition and the current legal realities as defined by the courts. And it carries significant implications for the legal liability of agents and the specific standard of care they owe to their clients.
Finally, let's discuss a really significant legal development: the apparent erosion of the long-standing duty to read legal doctrine.
Ah, yes, the Morrison case.
And the resulting broadening of potential liability for insurance agents, as highlighted by a recent decision from the Tennessee Supreme Court.
Traditionally, the legal principle known as the duty to read held that policyholders had a general responsibility to read and understand their insurance policy documents, including the initial application.
Right. You sign it, you own it.
Failure to do so could often prevent them from later making successful claims against either the insurance company or the agent involved.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Tennessee had previously held a particularly strict stance, even considering the failure to read a contract as a form of gross negligence on the part of the insurer.
But the case of Morrison v. Allen, decided by the Tennessee Supreme Court, represents a notable shift away from this long-established principle, particularly in the context of potential liability for insurance agents.
What happened in that case?
The case involved the Morrisons seeking to increase their existing life insurance coverage and relying on insurance agents Allen and Roberts to recommend suitable policies and to complete the necessary applications on their behalf.
Okay.
Critically, the agents incorrectly marked no in response to a question on Howard Morrison's application regarding any history of driving violations.
Oh.
Big mistake.
The Morrisons signed the completed applications without personally reviewing them. Subsequently, when Howard Morrison passed away, the life insurance claim was denied by the insurer due to his prior DUI conviction, which fell within the policy's contestable period.
And in a significant departure from previous precedent, the Tennessee Supreme Court ruled that the widow, Mrs. Morrison, could indeed recover damages from the insurance agents for their failure to procure a life insurance policy that would not be subject to contestability.
That's based on the prior driving violation. Regardless of the Morrisons' own failure to carefully read the applications before signing them.
That's a really significant development in the legal landscape that changes things.
The court's reasoning was that insurance agents hold themselves out as insurance professionals and, as such, should be held to a higher standard of care and expertise.
Mm-hmm.
They found that the agents had a contractual obligation to procure an enforceable insurance policy that met the Morrisons' needs and that they had breached that contract through their negligence in completing the application incorrectly.
Right.
Furthermore, the court determined that the Morrisons had reasonably relied on the agent's professional expertise in guiding them through the process and accurately recording their information.
The court explicitly rejected the argument that the applicant's signature on the application served as an absolute shield protecting a negligent insurance agent from liability for their own errors.
Can't hide behind the signature anymore.
They stated unequivocally that procuring an insurance policy that is subsequently deemed void or unenforceable due to the agent's negligence is just as detrimental to the insured as failing to procure any insurance coverage at all, as the insured does not receive the benefit of the bargain they sought.
The implications of this landmark decision are potentially far-reaching. It signifies a weakening of the traditional duty-to-read principle in Tennessee, at least in cases involving agent negligence,
right,
thereby increasing the potential accountability of insurance agents for their professional actions. The court also suggested that the commissions earned by insurance agents could be considered adequate compensation for the duty they owe to the insured to provide competent service, even in the absence of a separate explicit fee for advice. Interestingly, the court did not specifically address the question of whether an immediately incontestable life insurance policy was even available to the Morrisons at the time.
And while this particular case involved a life insurance policy, the material suggests that the legal principles established in Morrison v. Allen could potentially have broader implications for other types of insurance policies, such as property and casualty coverage, by analogy.
Right. Could apply elsewhere.
It could influence how courts view an agent's responsibility regarding various aspects of coverage and policy endorsements. It really underscores the two-edged sword of increased emphasis on agent expertise and professionalism, leading to a greater level of legal accountability.
It's a significant shift that ultimately points towards a greater level of responsibility for insurance producers to exercise competence and due care in serving the insurance needs of their clients.
Well, we've certainly covered a vast amount of ground today in our deep dive into insurance ethics.
We really have lots to think about.
We've explored everything from individual agents navigating complex moral dilemmas to the broader industry challenges of maintaining public trust in a rapidly changing world and the evolving legal responsibilities of insurance producers.
And hopefully this in-depth exploration has provided you, our listener, with valuable insights into the often unseen ethical considerations that truly shape the insurance landscape.
Yeah.
Understanding these subtle but critical nuances can empower you to be a more informed consumer of insurance products and to better appreciate the multifaceted challenges and responsibilities that insurance professionals navigate on a daily basis.
Think back to the last time you interacted with an insurance agent. Did any of these ethical considerations potentially come to play, even in subtle ways?
Good question to ponder.
How might having a greater awareness of these important issues shape your future interactions and the expectations you have within the insurance industry?
Yeah.
It's worth considering how the various standards of conduct and the ongoing discussion about professional status might influence the advice and service you receive.
It's also important to reflect on how the evolving legal landscape, particularly the shift away from a strict duty to read, might impact the responsibilities and liabilities of your insurance agent.
We would genuinely love to hear your thoughts and any follow-up questions that this deep dive has sparked for you.
Yeah, definitely.
Please connect with us through Mention Show's contact information social media to continue this important conversation.
Please do.
What other complex and thought-provoking topics would you like us to unpack in future deep dives?
We are always eager to explore new and relevant areas, so please do reach out and let us know your suggestions. Thanks for tuning in.